If anything's defined what humans have aspired to in the modern era, it's speed. And that certainly defines what's going on here. This is a dried out lake bed in the Mojave Desert in California. I'm at El Mirage. Now, it's well into the 40s here and I can see an almost ethereal sheen stretching across the horizon. But behind me are some of the most outlandish cars and motorcycles you'll ever see. There are souped up versions of road cars and low slung dragsters. And they're all queuing up at the start line to take their turn to hurtle off across the desert. And though the vehicles come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, they all have one thing in common: the pursuit of speed.
You sit all winter in your shops building your cars, and you build and you talk to it, you love it, you stroke it, you know, you do everything you can to get that extra mile an hour or 2 mile an hour.
When you're driving the thing, you get into a zone, you're looking at the instruments, you're looking at the cones whizzing by, and when those cones start looking like a picket fence, you know you're hauling ass.
In modern societies, we've very much come to be conditioned to believe speed is a good thing. If we look at the advertising industry for motor cars, it's about freedom of the open road. It's about being territorial.
There's a kind of fetishism almost around getting from A to B as quickly as possible. Culturally, we have become addicted to doing everything faster, and that's where the problem resides.
I wanted to ride in a silver machine when I was little. Well, actually, I wanted to fly one. "Dear Jim," I wrote, aged 7, "can you fix it for me to fly Concorde?" Funny to think that that letter could well be stashed away somewhere, not far from where I'm sitting, right here at the BBC, filed under reject. I never did hear back from Mr. Saville. But even now, aged, an adult, I'd still very happily give all this up tomorrow just for the chance to pilot a supersonic plane, or be an astronaut, or to have a go in a ramjet. The Jim'll Fix It generation dreamed of a supersonic future. But in these supposedly modern times, even the mega-rich are stuck with crossing the Atlantic at subsonic speeds. It's almost as if Concorde never happened. And as for me, the closest I've managed to get to the thrill of flying at Mach 2 is powering my way up through the gears on my motorbike. In this programme, I'll be asking just where our love affair with fast travel came from, and what does the future hold for speed in transport?
Buckle your seatbelt and hang on for this one.
The speed trial meet in the baking heat of the California desert is about as close to wacky races as real life ever gets. The eccentricity of the cars, in most cases, is matched only by that of their drivers. They don their fireproof suits and sit baking in their cramped driving compartments. In the air hangs the distinctive aroma of burgers mingled with petrol and sunblock.
Fast Freddy Dannenfelter, out of Santa Barbara, California.
Fast Freddy Feltzer is certainly living up to his name. He's herring across the desert. But those queuing at the start line, waiting to follow him, seem perfectly happy to share a few words with me. And one in particular catches my eye, a formidable-looking blonde, and she's not on 4, but on 2 wheels.
My name's Connie Beavers. I'm the rider of a 3777.
And this is her bike?
Yes, it's a Hayabusa 1350, turbocharged.
And I know it's very impolite to ask a woman her age, but roughly, what age bracket are you in?
I'm 70.
You're 70 years old?
Yeah.
Let me tell you that you don't look it. I mean that.
Thank you.
So, yeah, just tell us about the bike.
It's a turbocharged 1350. It's got about 400 horsepower.
So, I mean, that relates to a family, well, you know, kind of twice the average family car, just on a bike.
Yes, it is.
More than twice, actually.
Yes.
That's insane. How fast is it going?
I've taken it to 214.
The fastest I've been on a bike, well, it's probably illegal to say, but it's a lot less than that. That's just astonishing. As any biker knows, just trying to keep it straight at anything over 100 is hard work. How do you do it?
Well, it is a lot of concentration. It does, especially on the salt and on the dirt. It starts to get uneasy, you know.
Yeah, kind of fishtails.
Fishtails. Then here last year, I crashed at a 195. And they had to airlift me off here. I broke 12 ribs and a puncture of my lung, broke those shoulder blades, shattered my clavicle and my shoulder bone, and my hand. And so coming back after the accident was really scary.
Why did you come back after the accident then? I mean, it sounds like you nearly killed yourself. Why would you want to do it again?
Well, I think you're driven, you know, to not let it shatter your dreams.
What are you hoping to achieve today then? What speed?
I'm going to go 220. Actually, I want 230. That's the record. I did 214 4 days ago.
Brilliant.
My name's Chuck Edwall. I belong to the San Diego Roadster Club. And this is a daily driven car. It's got a 500 cubic inch Cadillac in it, turbo 400 transmission. And it's done a best out here of 162 miles an hour.
Tell us more about the engine. I mean, how big is it? You know, if somebody at home like has, a 3-liter engine in their car, how does that relate? 8 liters. How many cylinders?
It's eight. V8.
Okay. V8, so a seriously big engine. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fabulous looking car as well. Can you just describe it for us?
The car was built in 1948. I got it in 1986 and turned it into a semi-racer street car.
And if you imagine like the 1940s cars, you know, from the movies and stuff, that's pretty much what this looks like. And in fact, you'd never know it's 60 years old. It's in fantastic condition.
Oh, thank you.
But why do you want to go so fast then? What's the big draw of speed for you?
I need the rush. I mean, when I was younger, I raced motorcycles, I competed with skateboarding, I mean, I've done all kinds of edgy stuff, surfing. Now that I'm 65 years old now, and so it's a little harder to do that stuff, but I can still push the loud pedal.
And there's a chap over there, we're told he's 80 years old, there's a lady here, she's 70 years old we've been speaking to. So there do seem to be quite a few people, if you don't mind me saying, you know, of a senior age group here.
Absolutely.
Is it, what's the draw then for the more mature gentleman and lady?
People my age and older, they grew up in the early days of hot rodding. When hot rodding, we used to be able to come out here and run your car. You just hop in it with a t-shirt and Levi's on and go as fast as you can. Well, you can't do that anymore, but this is holy ground right here for hot rodding. This is where all of the major hot rod enthusiasts in history have come to make a name for themselves. It's a lake bed of legend.
I wished Chuck and Connie good luck, rather fearful that this dear, not-so-old lady could meet the same crushing fate as the last time. I suspect I was more nervous than she was. Meanwhile, the eagerly anticipated result for Fast Freddy Feltzer in car 44 was coming in.
Car 44 is 287.855.
287.855. That is fastest time of the day. Motorcycle 970. We'll be next out.
So, where did this obsession with speed begin? Well, I've come to an art museum in Islington in London, and I have to say, the surrounds here are in stark contrast to the madness and the heat and the dust of the Californian desert. I'm at the Esterick Collection, and the director here is Roberta Cremoncini. This is a wonderful collection of art from the Futurist movement. Can you just tell us about the Futurist movement and its relationship to speed?
The Futurists had this obsession with speed because it was a symbol of progress and the future. So speed was something was achieved for the first time at the beginning of the 20th century. So it was the epitome of modern life. So speed was a beauty itself.
So this idea of speed being an item of beauty, I must say it's not a thought that occurred to me when I was in that Californian desert with all the hot rodders. And I wonder if we can look at a few examples, because the space we're standing in here is on the ground floor of Esterick. The assistant curator here is Chris Adams. Can we just home in on some of the images here and see how they discuss and depict speed?
Absolutely. This is a painting by Balla, and it's called Speeding Automobile. But in actual fact, what you get is not really a depiction of the machine, but more this kind of vortex of lines. And Balla described this as being the essential force lines of speed. And it's almost like the wind and the disruption of the space as the car has sort of passed along the road. You see kind of an empty road, and this is like the dust and the smoke left in its wake almost.
I wonder almost as if the artist has closed his eyes and thought to himself, well, what does the notion of speed actually look like? And that seems to have been what's translated onto the canvas here.
Exactly, and all the colours, they're quite delicate, which is quite strange when you think of a speeding car. You maybe think of more bolder colours, but it always reminds me of the sort of the rainbow patterns in petrol. It's quite an interesting image, and it was a result of many in-depth studies by Balla to find the kind of the essence of speed.
And
And if that's what the essence of speed looks like, this could be what it sounds like. Pacific 231 by Arthur Honegger, an enthusiast of streamlined locomotives. He also admired the futurist cultural movement which brought together not only art and music, but also poetry and literature to convey our whirling life of steel, of pride, of fever, and of speed. Some would say we can actually trace our obsession with speed in the modern era right back to this Italian origin. It set the scene for the engineering innovations, especially in aviation, of the Second World War. And after all the action and adrenaline of the war, many returning servicemen went on to seek their kicks in the hot rods of the Californian desert, or in the skies, attempting to beat airspeed records.
And now here is the moment we've been waiting for. Mike Lithgow in the Supermarine Swift. Here he is. He seems to be about 50 feet above the sea. Here he is. He's past me now. And there he goes, tearing away towards the mountains at Yeffren. He's got the reheat on, and that is the thing that really makes the bang. Now, there are one or two children here today who are with the official observers, and they didn't like that noise one little bit.
But British pilot Mike Lithgow in his Supermarine Swift was very happy. In 1953, in Libya, at 737 miles an hour, he broke the airspeed record. From the turn of the 20th century until the 1960s, the record swapped hands almost every year. But the current fastest speed of 2,194 miles an hour, clocked up by an SR-71 Blackbird at Edwards Air Force Base in the United States, has stood since 1976.
Dedication, acceleration, turbojetification, that's what you need.
Whilst American dedication gives them the fastest aircraft, the British are the fastest on land. RAF fighter pilot Andy Green holds the current record of 763 miles an hour. He did it in 1997 in the Thrust SSC, the supersonic car. The project manager was Sir Richard Noble, who up till then was the fastest man on land himself, having set the record in 1983 in his Thrust 2 turbojet car, a couple of years after first speaking to Norris McWhirter about it on the BBC's Record Breakers.
I'm standing by the starboard cockpit of the twin cockpits of this remarkable example of automotive engineering, Thrust 2. It will generate a speed, it is hoped, of nearly a mile in under 6 seconds. The driver will be Richard Noble.
Which particular records are you going for on the way up, as it were?
Right, the fastest ever Briton. That record is held by the late Donald Campbell at 403.1 miles an hour. So that's one we want to catch on the way up. Second is Craig Breedlove's record of 600.601 miles an hour. This is what he achieved again for the measured mile, and it represents the fastest speed a jet-powered car has actually travelled. So we'd like to get that one as well. And then thirdly, the world land speed record, two passes over a measured mile within 60 minutes, held by Gary Gabelich of the United States.
Record Breakers there from 1981, and I actually watched that off air at the time, and it's amazing to think that here I am sitting with you, Sir Richard, watching that. This was, you know, the Thrust to this big idea to break the land speed record, which you went on to achieve. So how did that feel? How proud were you of that?
Oh, well, first of all, when we did that interview, I had no idea. None of us really had any idea how damn difficult it was going to be. But when we got it, there was just that fantastic moment that, you know, 9 years hard graft and we finally got it, you know. And amazing, absolutely amazing moment.
And when you're going really fast, what kind of feelings are going through your head there, apart from obviously trying to control the vehicle and being very focused on what you're doing? Does it have a greater thrill to it?
It's very interesting. What happens is your mental processes speed up to some sort of phenomenal speed, so it all happens in kind of slow motion. You've got extraordinary views, like, for instance, in the Thrust 2 car, as you get up to over 600 or so, the airflow starts to go supersonic over the wheel arches and over the intakes. And on a cold day, you'll actually see the shockwave standing up there as the airflow goes supersonic. And when you go through the deceleration phase, so when you deployed the parachute, we lost speed at 6G, so you lost speed at 132 miles an hour per second per second. And then you get an extraordinary effect called the somatographic illusion. This upsets the inner ears. And rather like an old television set, you know, when sometimes the picture sort of moves up and down. In this case, what actually happens is under extreme deceleration, the picture moves up and you're convinced you're driving vertically into the earth down a mineshaft. It's a most extraordinary experience. I can't explain it. But for the first time this happened to me, I thought I was ill or something.
You obviously still hold the record, or your team still holds the land speed record at Mach 1.02.
Yeah.
That has stood since 1997. So
absolutely.
How come it's lasted so long? Is it just impossible to do better than that, or is nobody bothering? What's the score there?
Well, it's rather sad, isn't it, really? Because as far as the thrust SSC team's concerned, obviously we were rather sort of hoping that, you know, maybe we might hold it for 4 or 5 years and the Americans would come back and we'd see this all develop. But again, we should be pushing forward. We really should be pushing forward. You know, it's kind of symbolic of the nation's ability, I think.
I think it's fascinating the way we have invested speed itself with a kind of totemic importance, that it's become the ultimate yardstick for our success as a culture or society, that we must always be going faster, otherwise we're not progressing.
A differing view on our obsession with speed from journalist and author of the book In Praise of Slow, Carl Honoré. For him, this need to go fast all the time is pervasive, but ultimately unsatisfying.
I think that this futurist idea of speed as a beautiful thing in and of itself, and speed as a high, noble ideal, it's still very much embedded in our culture. You think about how we try to improve anything. What do? We speed it up. You know, we used to read, we speed read. You know, we used to dial, now we speed dial. We used to walk, now we speed walk. We used to date, and now we even speed date. And I think in some ways, in recent years, we've reached a point where, yes, for many years, speed was doing all kinds of good, and it was a wonderful thing to be pursuing it. But I think we've entered a stage of diminishing returns now for speed, where there's less interest out there in pushing these speed records back and breaking them constantly. And I wonder, maybe more and more people around the world are starting to ask, faster, why? What is the point of doing everything more quickly? What is the point of breaking these speed records?
So just what is it that makes the gear grinders of the world so desperate to go so fast? Over in California with those plucky, wacky racers at El Mirage, I'm keen to find out, firstly, whether my new bestest friend on two wheels, Connie, is still alive, but also just why people like her invest so much time, money and emotion in the risky pursuit of speed.
Well, back with Connie now. She's the lovely lady we spoke to earlier. You know, she's just done the course on her 3777 bike. Connie, how did it go?
It went real well. My top speed so far here has been 204, and I just went 216.132.
Wow. So I'm speaking to a woman who, in the last half an hour or so, at the age of 70, if you don't mind me saying, has just done over 216 miles an hour.
I have 6 kids and 13 grandkids.
Are they going to be proud of you?
Oh, they are.
What does it mean to you? You know, you've gone well over your existing record, personal record of 204 miles an hour. How does that feel?
This whole game really is about self-improvement. You know, it's self-challenging, especially at my age. You know, most people my age are sitting on the front porch, you know, are not doing much.
Are you going to try and do another run today and beat that 216?
We'll do another run today. Because our goal is to get up to 230 in this season.
Connie went off to put her leathers back on, and I opted to take a break from all those screaming engines and screeching tyres, and instead meandered around the many team trailers around the track. At one, I found a line of men enjoying some nice cool beers in the 40-degree sun. They were just kicking back, discussing gearboxes and engines, and exchanging all kinds of stories of engineering conquests, past and present. Luckily, Joanne Carlson was around to introduce my producer and I to them. She's the organisation's administrator, and she's pretty much the lady who keeps the show on the road and the men in check.
OK, are you all paying attention? Wake up, Tony.
Oh. It's been a long day.
Yeah, it has.
The Michelle and Gareth are with the BBC, and they are here doing a radio show about land speed racing and why you do it, how you got started in it, etc.
We're just trying to find out why you people are so obsessed with speed. So who wants to go first? What's so brilliant about going fast?
He's the youngest one, so he's fresh in his mind. We've been doing it for years.
I don't know why you do it. It's a disease or something.
In a nutshell, this place has been racing out. They've been racing out here since the 30s and the 40s. The future of the sport is a little thin right now because, as you see, most of these guys around here are pretty gray-haired and pretty long of teeth.
What are you trying to say here, then? Is there an ageist agenda going? Yeah. Okay, so what about this racing thing? Is it a macho thing about you? Is it, you know, proving your manhood, that kind of thing? Is that part of it?
No, we're all pretty macho already.
Yeah, you don't strike me as people who need to prove their manhood. I'd like to point that out, obviously.
I kind of see what you're pushing at. It's really not a macho thing out here. Like, for me, I'm an engine builder and tuner, so this is a place for me to stack up against other engine builders and tuners and see how good I do against them. Some of the records will swap records back and forth.
Yeah. He's
been doing it. Tony's been doing it for a number of years. And it's really not a macho thing out here.
Yeah, but you're all out here, you know, risking your lives in the heat and the dust of the desert. You know, why don't you just give this up and go to a nice green, lush golf course, you know, take it easy a little bit, maybe get a sailing boat. Why are you so obsessed with coming here, you know, taking all these risks all the time?
Go golfing?
Yeah, why not?
I have never swung a club in my life.
I've actually golfed, and it's way more painful than this.
Keep to the left on I-15.
Away from the desert then, and now I'm on one of the major Californian interstate highways. Although I'm not really going anywhere fast, I'm certainly not going to be breaking any speed records anytime soon. The traffic's just been crawling along, which is rather curious when you think that at times this highway gets to 6 lanes wide. And yet in the last 2 hours, in fact over 2 hours, I've done the grand total of 32.5 miles. So much for speed, huh? Well, Glenn Lyons would certainly agree with that. He's at the Centre for Transport and Society at the University of the West of England.
Ironically, one can find that by all of us trying to travel by the fast mode of car, we all find that we're moving at a snail's pace. And as we look out the window, it's the cyclist and the pedestrian who actually is getting to their destination more quickly and arguably more healthily than we are ourselves as motorists. What you don't want to happen in that environment is to find yourself behind a slow driver. They're encroaching upon your territory, upon your space, and you're in a world in which the social norm is to try and get to places quickly. We're in a society which expects instant gratification, and I think that's created almost an inbuilt expectation that quicker is better.
I think what a lot of these fast forms of transport end up doing is making us very frustrated. If you look at modern cars now and the speedometer, even the smallest cars go up to 150, 160. And when are you ever going to drive at that speed? And of course, in London now, the speed of the average journey is roughly the same as it was in Victorian times when people puttered around in horse-drawn carriages because, you know, we have the cars, they can go 180. But when do you ever get to go more than 20? You know, most of the time you're stuck in traffic. So there's this horrible irony and paradox about these fast forms of transport is that we've got all that power throbbing below the bonnet, the promise of speed, it's always there, the flick of a switch or the push of a pedal, but we can never use it. It's just always just out of our reach. And I think that's maybe one reason why people have so much road rage, that they're marinated in all this frustration, all this speed that could almost be, but just can't quite happen.
Carl Honoré again. But now it's not just congestion slowing us down, it's environmental concerns. Our need for speed is giving way to our need to be green. Car adverts don't talk about 0 to 60 anymore. These days, they tout the vehicle's energy-saving credentials. And the environmental imperative was one reason for the demise of the very thing that fired me up so much when I was a kid that I wrote to Jim'll Fix It.
Taking off into a New York sunrise, BA-002, the last supersonic passenger flight to cross the Atlantic. Lifting into the skies with its characteristic elegance and the distinctive roar of the engines, there is no other aircraft like this. There will probably never be another aircraft like this, and so it marks the end of an extraordinary chapter in aviation history.
And it was a chapter I saw drawing to a close myself. I confess that I took the day off in 2003 when Concorde made that final flight so I could photograph it from the top floor of my flat in South London as it flew over for the very last time. The supersonic passenger era had to end because the Speedbird burnt too much fuel to be economically or environmentally viable.
aviation these days isn't so much about how fast you can get people from A to B, but how many you can transport.
Concorde is a very interesting example, I think, because it probably is the first time in human history that we have chosen to abandon a form of transport that was faster than what we already have. I think maybe Concorde marks the beginning of a sea change in the way we think about speed. I think that to some extent, we're going to have to get used to traveling more slowly. And in a way, maybe we should start thinking about that not as a sacrifice, but as a gain, as a luxury of enjoying the journey, relearning the lost art of travel.
One of the attractions of making a journey is obviously to get to one's destination. But in research we've done, we've looked at the positive value of the journey itself. The first is the notion of transition time. If one imagines being a parent at the breakfast table with the children getting ready for school, you don't want to teleport yourself to the business meeting or to the shop floor in an instant. You need to make an adjustment between your life roles. And people tell us that they want that time, especially on the journey to work, to make the transition. Now, historically, though we might beg to differ, the price of fuel relative to the cost of living has been relatively affordable and easily accessible. And yet, in recent months, we find ourselves in new territories where fuel prices have gone up at really quite substantial rates. Now, whilst we have this mindset of faster being better, then, of course, there's a strong temptation to travel faster and use more fuel. And yet in a world in which these resources are becoming more precious, perhaps we do need to look back inside our travel experience and think that perhaps 10 more minutes of Terry Wogan in the slow lane of the motorway isn't such a bad thing.
So, despite our insatiable appetite for speed and the constant urge to go everywhere and do everything faster, perhaps we're all actually going to have to learn to slow down. Yet back here at El Mirage in California at this land speed meeting, try telling these racers to slow down. For them, it's all about screaming engines, adrenaline, and, above all, speed.
It's just, it's like winning the Super Bowl. It's like winning the World Series. To us, it is the ultimate thing. Faster, faster, faster.
Daddy! What you need if you want to be a vroom, vroom land speed record breaker. Yeah, yeah, yeah.